Okay, so what is your name?
Raymond Redford, but I prefer to be called Ray.
And where were you born?
I was born at Walton Hospital in Liverpool
and
in 1945.
Nice. So what date was it when you were born?
The 3rd of July.
And what did your parents do for a living?
Well, my dad was a labourer on the Liverpool docks when there were 20,000 people employed on the docks in those days. Not any longer. And my mother had a lot of different jobs, but none after the children came along. One of which was she was a tram conductress on the Liverpool trams during the war when the bombs were falling. Some great stories she's got about that.
Yeah.
But there for another day, I think.
Yeah, another time. And where did you go to school?
I went to school in Liverpool, of course. I went first of all to a school called Major Leicester School. And there's a statue of Major Leicester. Not a military major, that was his name.
Okay.
Major Leicester, who was a Liverpool clergyman who did a lot of work for underprivileged children who had no shoes, basically, running around the streets of Liverpool. So the school was named after him. That school was in Everton Valley. Changed its name now to Hope Valley School. And soon to change its name to Four Oaks.
I think I've heard
how
of that, yeah.
Times change. And after that, I went to the Allsop High School in Walton. And I passed Goodison Park on the way to school.
Brilliant school. So, Ray, how long have you supported Everton Football Club?
I don't know, really, but it was probably when I was about 7 or 8, which makes it 56 years ago now. Yeah, I'd be about 7 or 8, I suppose. It's a long time. Yeah.
And why was it that you supported Everton Football Club in the first place?
Well, I've heard it said that when boys get to the age of about 7 or 8, they start to think a little bit more for themselves. And my dad was a Liverpool fan, right till the day he died, had a season ticket and everything. And when I was about 7 or 8, Everton had just come back up into the first division, and Liverpool had gone down. And I think it was the same season they went down into the second division, about 1953 or 4, something like that. And I think that was it for me. But I do have a great recollection of going to see the other team in Liverpool, coming home from Wembley in 1950 when I was 5. And I remember sitting on my dad's shoulders, watching the team bus, an old, it must have been a bus, I suppose, and coming up towards Anfield, going back sort of thing, after having been to Wembley. But they lost to Arsenal in the final 2-0. But there was a lot of fans out watching them, and I was sitting on my dad's shoulders, and I was only 5 that season, so I must have changed from being a Liverpoolian then, under my dad's influence, to making my own mind up when I was about 7 or 8.
So your family itself, is it mainly Liverpool fans then?
No, one of I've got two younger brothers, the older of which is a Red, like his dad. But the youngest brother, the youngest of the three is a Blue. So there were two Reds and two Blues in the family. So my mother had to be a neutral.
Must
keep the peace.
Must have been a pain on derby days and things like that.
I suppose it must have been, yeah.
So Ray, what was your first Everton game that you went to?
You know, I can't remember. Isn't that a terrible thing? To spend all your life supporting Everton and you can't remember the first match. But I remember being in the ground when I was a little lad. Okay, maybe 8 or 9 or something like that. But in those days you could go and get in when they opened the gates. And I don't know whether I went in the boys' pen or in the ground itself, but I remember being there and Everton were playing. And I remember Peter Farrell was playing. He was the captain. Tommy Eglinton was playing. And somebody called John Willie Parker, who was their leading goal scorer at the time. But I'm blowed if I know who the first match was against. But I remember being there that day.
What was the atmosphere like then?
Well, first of all, I couldn't see very much. But the ground wasn't full, because don't forget, everyone stood up in those days. Well, they didn't, but you know, everybody at ground level was standing. So you could always find a space, sort of dodging between the men. You'd have no chance of seeing if it was full, but there was plenty of room, and you could always get a view, especially if somebody moved out the way to let you see.
So do you remember how you got there, and before you got actually into Goodison, do you remember how you got there?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Probably there was a gang of little lads lived near me, and we all went together, and we were, because where I lived, which was just up Everton Valley, it was actually slightly nearer to the other ground, to Anfield, than it was to Goodison Park. And we used to make a ritual of it. We'd go to the cinema for the children's matinee on a Saturday afternoon. That would be about 1 o'clock, that show, I suppose. And that would go on till about 4 o'clock. By then it was turned half time in the football. And then we'd go along till they opened the gates to let people out. And they'd allow little lads in to go and watch. And so we would have walked as a gang, you know, maybe six or seven of us, to the ground and gone in to watch. And probably I would have gone into Anfield before I went into Goodison, because it was slightly nearer.
Right, where was
that's how we would have gone.
Where was the cinema then?
The cinema was at the bottom of Mere Lane, now a bingo palace. It was just called the Mere Lane Cinema, but long since ceased to be a cinema.
So who is your favourite player of the past?
I can't name one, so I'll have to trawl through the memory and see if I can come up with a few for you, because probably my first idol was Dave Hickson, with the blonde quiff, because I had a blonde quiff in those days. But Dave Hickson, fearless centre forward, run through brick walls and die for Everton. I think Davey said, I would give blood for any team I played for, but I'd give my life for Everton. And he would have done too. I can't remember whether I just know this for a fact, or whether I was actually there, but there was one famous occasion when he played with 5 stitches across his forehead, blood pouring out, and he scored the winner with a diving header in the mud at Goodison Park. I can believe I was there, but I don't know whether I was or not. You know, it's one of those things that I may have been there, but I don't know for sure. And some of the favourite players I've had over the years since then have been Bobby Collins, who was the captain of Everton. I think he came down from Scotland. I think he played for Celtic, and he was about 5'5". And he'd take anybody on, a bit like modern Billy Bremner. Fight anybody, Bobby Collins. And he was the skipper and a real tough nut. And we sold him to Leeds after he'd given us great service. But he was a fabulous footballer, little Bobby Collins. And I remember one year, I don't know how come my mother did this, but she cut a picture out of the newspaper of Bobby Collins with the ball. About a foot tall, I suppose it was, nearly as big as him. And she put it on the Christmas tree in the front room. How about that? No Santa Claus, no fairy. Bobby Collins was on the Christmas tree. How about that? So maybe I persuaded her to do it. I don't know. And another favourite player of mine was Albert Dunlop, Everton's goalie at the time. Not a big fella like goalies are these days. You know, no Peter Schmeichel this. He was about 5'10", I suppose, and wide with it. And what a fabulous shot stopper he was. Wasn't very tall, but I used to admire him because I'm not very big myself. And mind you, no, it was Bobby Collins. But, you know, I could see the real skill and determination in young, small players to make a name for themselves. Yeah, perhaps more so in those days, whereas most goalies these days are massive men, aren't they, really? Certainly well over 6 feet tall. Another player I really liked, and an odd choice this maybe, but Billy Bingham, a little Irish international. I don't know where we signed him from. Maybe Nottingham Forest or Luton Town or somebody like that, you know, that were knocking about in the first division at the time. An Irish outside right. Later became Everton's manager. But I used to really like him. I don't know why. You just don't know why you like some players, do you? But really liked Billy Bingham. Another one was a right winger, just like Billy Bingham, but a different style of player altogether, Alex Scott, a Scotsman. Don't know where we signed him from, but obviously a Scottish team. And he was one of these who could put his head down and run and knock people out the way. A really muscular sort of centre-forward style of outside right. Don't make them like that anymore. You know, really quick, fast, determined, get his head down and go. A lot of black curly hair. I remember him seeing, play against Inter Milan. And I think I'd like to say more about that if I get the chance. Saw him play against Inter Milan and he cut in off the right wing and hit one with his left foot. And he couldn't kick with his left foot, Alex Scott. And he whizzed it and it rattled off the crossbar and out again. And that would have given us the lead against Inter Milan. But never mind, eh?
What year was Alex the Inter Scott. Milan game, sorry?
I think that was 63, I think. It would have been September or October 1963. So by then I was 18. So playing myself in those days, of course. And then another great idol of mine was Jimmy Gabriel. Jimmy played in the midfield, right midfield, mostly. And he played in the 1966 Cup Final. The proper Cup Final, not the World Cup. The proper Cup Final at Wembley when Everton beat Sheffield Wednesday. And he was a fabulous player, Jimmy. He could play centre-half, right-half, left-half. And on lots of occasions, centre-forward. Up front on his own when Everton were a bit shy of a proper striker in those days. Jimmy was always the one who would play anywhere. A bit like Tim Cahill these days, you know, but a bigger lad than Tim Cahill. And I think, for until quite recently, Jimmy Gabriel was on the ground staff at Everton, doing some backroom job or other. But don't know for sure, but I think he might still be.
I think he was a coach under Joe Royal.
Was he?
Yeah, in the 1995-96. Yeah.
But I think he lasted since then. But never mind. But, you know, there's lots of players that I've really liked from the proper past. Yeah.
Have you ever had a chance to meet any of your favourite players?
None of them, no. None of them. But I did meet two former Everton players. Once, I worked in Manchester one time, and I was very friendly with a lad who was a Manchester City fanatic. And one night he said he was going along to the City Supporters Club. What? But they didn't meet at a central place. They used to meet all round in different places around the outskirts of Manchester. And they were meeting in a pub near where I was working at the time and staying in Diggs in Urmston in Manchester. And he said, "You come along." I said, "I might as well. There's nothing else to do tonight." So I went along. And blow me, who turned up? But Joe Mercer, who'd been a great Everton player, of course, just after the war. And of course he was the manager of Manchester City at the time, or he might, and I think he was joint manager with Malcolm Allison. So I was able to go and have a chat to Joe Mercer and tell him that my dad used to watch him play, and I thought Joe would just say, "Oh yeah, but he was quite interested. "Where did your dad live?" And when I said, "Oh, he lived in Liverpool." "Oh, I know he lived in Liverpool," he said, "but whereabouts?" And when I said, "Up Everton Valley," he said, "What street?" I thought, "Hey, up." I said, "What? You don't know the street?" He said, "Tell me what street it was." I said, "It was Carmel Street." He said, "Oh, I used to walk past Carmel Street on the way to the ground. I used to live up there myself when I first started playing for Everton. You wouldn't believe it, would you, these days? A player walking to the ground." But they did. Joe Mercer, great Everton. May have even been the captain.
Where did he play himself?
Right half, I think. Right midfield in those days, right half, yeah.
Going back to Dave Hixon, how did you react to his death a few years ago?
Yeah, very sad, wasn't it? It reminds you that we're all going to grow old one day, isn't it? Great heroes like that, you think, uh-oh. But then again, you know, they've all got to go. But I think he got proper respect from the fans, because he played for Liverpool as well, of course. And dare I say, Aston Villa even. And so I'm sure the fans of both Liverpool and Everton would acknowledge that he was a wonderful player. And I heard on the radio just the other day, and here we are speaking now in April 2010, that his wife Pat is still going strong. And it was her 80th or 82nd birthday just the other day. I heard it mentioned on the radio by Billy Butler, of course. He was a great Everton fan himself. Yeah,
he's a very lovely man. I've met him a couple of times. Dave Hixon.
Davey, yeah.
When I was a small child going on the Everton tour, and he was just the absolute gent. Everything you expect from him.
He's a really nice man. Yeah,
professional. But, to the present. Who's your favourite player in the current Everton lineup?
I admire lots of them, but that's not the same as thinking, wow, what a great player. I think the one that gets my greatest admiration is Pienaar, because when he's not in the team, you can tell the difference. He's got a great energy, marvellous skill, fast, direct, doesn't mess about, gets stuck in. He is another one who will give blood for Everton. Not sure about give his life, but give blood for Everton. And I'm a bit worried in case all these rumours of him not signing another contract for Everton before he goes to the World Cup, I think that would be a great tragedy. But not my favourite player in the present squad. But and that's got to go to Jack Rodwell. Because as soon as I saw that young man play a couple of years ago, I thought, wow, core. You just got to look at him, haven't you? And you know, he's class. Yeah. And when he scored against Man United the other week, I thought, whoa. I wasn't there, but I do wish I had been there.
Yeah. How do you compare the players now to back then in terms of, you know, the way they play?
I know lots of players, lots of fans these days say, they're not fit to lace the boots of the players in my day, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But I reckon an Everton team from now would slaughter an Everton team of the 50s. Absolutely slaughter them on skill, on stamina. The players in those days were, you know, drinkers and smokers and heaven knows what. The players these days, I think, are a bit more dedicated than they were then to the sport and their lifestyle, you know, in terms of modern living and all that sort of thing. Ice baths and proper diets and scientific regimes to their fitness, better recoveries and all that sort of thing. I mean, in those days, you'd see a player, he'd come home with a bandage on his knee, you know, and sort of be limping after 10 minutes and get through the match. Well, you couldn't tolerate that anymore now. You know, if you're not operating at 100 miles an hour, flat out for 90 minutes, you know, I don't think they'd be fit to live with the players today. But I could be wrong.
How about the players' relationship with the fans in terms of, you were speaking about Joe Mercer talking to you in a pub, and do you think an Everton player now would speak to you the same as someone in the past?
Sad to say, probably not. Sad to say. But I think that's more to do with, I don't know, the dangers of modern life, if you like. I mean, how many players these days are in a fortress of a house behind locked gates with cameras and all that, and they still get broken into and robbed, don't they?
Yeah.
They can't afford to expose themselves to too much, can they really? Which is terribly sad. And I don't think it's just because of modern times. I think they've got that much money now, they've got that much more to lose. You couldn't imagine anyone wanting to rob Joe Mercer because he had nothing to steal. So the players from those days, you know, were just, to use his name, an ordinary Joe, weren't they really?
They had second jobs back then, didn't they?
Well, of course they did, yeah. Well, yeah, not too sure about after the war, but they certainly did before the war, yeah, yeah.
So who is your favourite manager of the past?
I'd have to say it's... There have been three that I've thought very highly of. And the first one was the one who really started to make Everton into a modern team, and that was Johnny Carey. He was the first one, I think, that John Moores gave a lot of money to spend to buy new players for the squad. It wasn't a squad in those days. If you were bought, you were in the team. You know, there was no such thing as buying a squad player. Johnny Carey had charge of, if you like, the Moores millions. Everton called a millionaire team in those days, I suppose, and were spending money along with Tottenham to buy big players. And so Johnny Carey started to make Everton a modern era sort of team. He was followed, of course, after he was sacked in the taxi by John Moores and all that stuff. John Moores would say he didn't sack him. Johnny Carey would say he did. I think the common view was probably they agreed to differ, and John Carey, that was left with no alternative but to accept that he was getting out of that taxi as an ex-employee. But the next manager, of course, was Harry Catterick. Strange man, I believe, don't know too much about him other than what I've heard since, but he brought the first title in my time to Goodison Park and then led us on to the cup final. I think it was 62-3 when we won the, you're going to say 61-2.
I can't even remember.
62, I think it was, when Everton, or 62, no, it was 62-3 season. Everton were champions, having been second, I think, second or third the previous year, under Harry Catterick in his first season. They'd signed Harry Catterick. Everton had, I don't know if you signed managers in those days, it, somehow you acquired them, didn't you? We got Harry Catterick from Sheffield Wednesday, who were then a top team. And he brought the first titles to Everton. But of course, you can't other than overlook Howard Kendall, can you? The team of the 80s, when, you know, he could do no wrong, could he? And we all know why he had to leave, don't we? Because of what happened at Heysel. And Everton were champions and were going to go and play in the European Cup the following year. But we, with that fabulous team we had, but it wasn't to be. And I'm sure Kendall and Everton would have gone on to the 10 years of top flight, top honours, maybe even made their mark in Europe better than they did. Cup Winners' Cup was all very well, but would have been nice to win the big one, wouldn't it, really? But Howard Kendall, probably the best manager we've had in any event, apart from who we've got now. But then again, we're talking about the past at the moment, yeah.
But David Moyes himself, do you feel he's carrying on a tradition?
I'm sure he is. I mean, under Joe Royal, well, though we did under Joe, because we won the cup, but I think he brought about too much of a work ethic and not enough of a skill ethic at Goodison. And, you know, we do like to call ourselves the School of Science, don't we, after all? And I think when Joe acquired the Dogs of War nickname for this team, I think that still sticks amongst some. And in the early days of David Moyes, of course, we had some fearsome midfield players, some of whom have had hair. Some fearsome midfield players, and I think the tradition was almost being carried on then. But I think David Moyes has now introduced it more of a work ethic rather than a, you know, a tireless chase them till they drop sort of ethic. And there's a great mix of skill and working for the team right from the back to the front now. And you know, I think if anyone should be persuaded to stay at Goodison, apart from the star players, it's got to be David Moyes. I think the chairman's got to be much admired for sticking with him, you know, and keeping him there, because he knows that's what really makes a successful team, is continuity, isn't it? Dare I say, you know, you better look down the East Lancs Road, haven't you, to the great team that United have got now. It's not been brought about by accident, has it? It's continuity. But City have had about five managers in 10 minutes, haven't they? And what do they hope to achieve? Yeah.
Going back to Howard Kendall, yeah. Do you think he should have come back the two times he came afterwards?
No, great mistake. The first time wasn't so bad, but coming back again is a nonsense, really. I think it smacked of a bit of desperation, didn't it, really? Who are we going to get? Because we had a couple of, well, duck eggs, didn't we? Mm. With Lee and who, heavens. Best not talk about those managers, I don't think, because they were really in. We were in the doldrums then, and those managers weren't doing much to get us out of it.
So, what was your most memorable Everton match that you've seen or been to?
Been to. It's got to be the 1966 FA Cup final. For several reasons. I was 21 that summer. Wasn't yet 21. And I've been working a couple of years and worked with three or four really keen Evertonians, and a couple of them had season tickets, but I couldn't afford a season ticket at that age. And three of them got tickets for the final and I didn't. And I was not best pleased. My uncle was a member of the supporters club and he tried all roads to get me a ticket for the final, but he only got three. One for himself, one for his wife, my auntie, who was a fanatical Evertonian herself, and their son, my cousin Stephen, and they were going. And they said they'd take me down, but I'd have to look after myself. But the three lads from work, they said they were going, and they'd take me down, but I'd have to look after myself. So I tossed up. and I went with the lads from work. And I left them. They went into the ground, and I was wandering around outside, desperate, looking for the ticket. And I suddenly saw a little crowd round a bloke with a smart blazer on, maroon blazer with a badge on it, and a tie, and a white shirt and everything. And I thought, I'll get over there. And he was offering tickets for £6.10, £6.50. Now, the face value of the tickets was 10 shillings, 50 pence. 10 shilling ticket, and he was offering tickets for £6.50 to stand up. And I said, I might never come to Goodison again. I said, I'll give you £6. Now, bear in mind, that was a damn lot of money in those days. It might have been the equivalent of 300 quid today, half a week's good pay. And he went, go on then. So I had a ticket in my hand. I didn't know where it was for, which end it was. I just knew it was in Block J. And I pegged it at Wembley Way with this ticket in my hand, about 5 to 3, sweaty, desperately looking for where J was. And I ran in, and to my great relief, it was at the Everton end. And I was in. And just as I ran up the steps and through onto the terraces, didn't know anybody, just me on my own, the whistle blew for the start of the game. How about that?
Perfect.
Lovely sunny day in May 1966. But of course, that was against Sheffield Wednesday, and we went 2-0 down. Oh, Jesus. We were all mortified. But then, we suddenly got a goal back by Mike Trebilco, who was a young player that Harry Katterick had dared pick for the final, ahead of Fred Pickering, who was our leading scorer. Pickering was dropped for the final. Everton fans thought he was mad. And Mike Trebilco turns up and scores 2 goals and puts us level, 2-2. Of course, the roof come off now. Everton have really got the tails up. And I forget who he was. I think it might have been Brian Lebone, who cleared a long ball out of defence. And their centre-half, I think his name is Young, might have been Vic Young, he tried to trap it and it went under his foot, just inside their half, and Derek Temple went after it like a rabbit. Only the goalie to beat, but he was 40 yards out at the stage, and he kept going and going, and he didn't dribble around the goalie like players do nowadays. Sent him the wrong way and put it in the other side into the far corner. Wonderful. I think that was about 15 minutes ago. We were 3-2 up. Of course, Everton had all on then to keep the lead. And I remember Jimmy Gabriel running over right into the corner. Players do it a lot these days. When you're winning, get the ball into their corner flag and keep it there. And Gabriel was standing in the corner with his foot on the ball, going like this, to the Sheffield players to come and get it off him. But it was at the far end from me, so I didn't really milk the moment as best as I could. But coming out of there, we were ecstatic. Of course, I had to then get my way back to my mates. And we'd all arranged to meet at Ealing Broadway station afterwards. I don't know where Ealing Broadway is now, but it sticks in my mind. I had to get the tube back to Ealing Broadway. Whereas all I wanted to do was to celebrate. But these were three married men. They wanted to go home. So I had to make my way back to Ealing Broadway station and wait for them outside. And I don't know what time it was. It must have been 6:30, I suppose, when I got there. And they were standing there waiting for me. Didn't know whether I'd got in or not. And when I said I'd got in, we were all dancing round up and down on the pavement afterwards, because we'd all got in to see the final.
Did you get the train there and back?
No, we drove.
Oh, you drove.
He took his car to... Oh, that's why. Ealing must be some way out of the outskirts of London somewhere. And he'd parked his car, that's right. Keith Smith, his name was. He'd parked his car at Ealing. And then we'd gone in on the tube. And so we all went back to his car, and he insisted on driving. Oh, we stopped in Coventry for a Chinese, I think, halfway home. But who was to tell in Coventry that we were Everton fans on the way back from a cup final? But a funny thing, when Everton played the semi-final that year, I wasn't there. But I was watching the other semi-final, Chelsea playing Sheffield Wednesday. Stupid. How stupid is that? But I was at university in those days, in Coventry, funny enough, at Lanchester Poly. And down there, tickets for the semi-final were easy to come by. It was being played at Aston Villa's ground, and people had tickets. People in Coventry had tickets for the semi-final, Chelsea versus Sheffield Wednesday. Why would they? Isn't that stupid? But I got a ticket. So a couple of us who were at college together went to Villa Park to watch the other semi-final, Sheffield Wednesday and Chelsea. And Chelsea were bound to win. There was no contest. Chelsea were going to beat Aston Villa. Sorry, were going to beat Sheffield Wednesday. But blow me, Sheffield Wednesday beat them. And all the way through, I kept looking behind me up to the scoreboard, behind whatever the open cop was called in those days. I don't think it was the Holt end, I think it's the other end. And every time I looked around, it was 0-0. 0-0. 0-0. And as the final whistle blew at Villa Park, Chelsea had lost. Sheffield Wednesday were going to Wembley. I turned round and I just saw the scoreboard go 0. And it changed like that, rolled round to 1. And I jumped up and down, screaming, and everyone was looking at me as if, what's the matter with him? And I say, look at the scoreboard. Man United 0, Everton 1. We've beaten them. Colin Harvey had scored at, I think it was at Bolton Wanderers ground. Silly, I mean, you wouldn't play a semi-final at Bolton these days, but yeah, we'd beaten. Colin Harvey had scored one of his rare goals for Everton, and we'd beaten Man United. So the final was all on for Man United and Chelsea that season, but it turned out that we got a better final out of Everton and Sheffield Wednesday.
Going back to the final that you went to, what were your impressions of Wembley and seeing so many Everton fans there to celebrate the team?
Well, it was strange because both teams played in blue and white. Didn't play in the final in blue and white. Sheffield Wednesday wore all white, but their home kit was blue and white stripes. So all their fans were in blue as well. So it was a bit of a strange occasion. You know, a bit like Liverpool and Manchester United playing, everyone would be in red, apart from yellow, you know, these days. But it was odd. But the much more noise seemed to be coming from the blue end because I was there. And, you know, everybody for miles around was talking with a Liverpool accent and screaming their heads off. Yeah.
Did you have your replica shirt on?
Pardon? No, no. In fact, no, I don't think many people wore replica shirts in those days. In fact, even the fella who ran on the pitch, where everyone knows who ran on, his name was Cavana. He was rugby tackled by a police constable who was running with his helmet on. How stupid is that, you know? A proper Bobby's helmet, chasing an Everton fan across the pitch. But even he wasn't wearing a replica shirt. Nobody did. He was wearing a suit with trousers and the shoes and everything. No trainers even, because I don't think trainers were the fashion in those days. And this police constable lost his helmet and then rugby tackled Cavana. And Cavana turned around and pushed him like that and pushed the policeman off and kept running across the pitch like that. When we'd scored to make it 3-2. No replica shirts in those days.
When that man Cavana ran on the pitch, what would all the Everton fans react? How would they react?
I think we were still celebrating the goal, but he decided to go one better and go over the fence. Yeah.
Right. So, how do you think that going to the match has changed?
Well, for me personally, it's obviously changed because of all seats and stuff like that. But for me personally, I don't go as often. When I live near the ground, and I lived in Everton until I was 29, I think it was, when I moved away. Still living at home with my mum and dad, because you did in those days. You didn't just leave home when you were 18 and set up in a flat and whatever young people do these days. You stayed at home with your mum and dad till you were getting married and all that jazz. So I was still at home I was about 26 or 7, that's right, when we moved away to Fazakerley. So for years I used to go on the bus, because it was a straight run through. I didn't have a car. But even when I did have a car, it was a waste of time taking it because you couldn't park anywhere near. Anyway, so I'd go on the bus. And nowadays, I live in the south end of the city and I travel by car. And if I couldn't go in a car, I don't think I'd go at all. It's a strange thing.
Whereabouts do you live in the south of Liverpool now?
In Allerton. Yeah. Posh end, you know.
Huh. I'm in Hunts Cross, so that's
not far away then. Yeah. Not far away, right, yeah. But you know, going to the football's changed completely, hasn't it? Because in those days, the vast majority of the support came from certainly 10, 20 miles around. You might have got some from North Wales. Everton had a great following, strangely enough, though, from Dublin. People had come over on the Dublin boat on a Friday night, stay in a little hotel in town, go and watch the match and go home again.
Did you have a season ticket?
On the midnight. Never had a season ticket now. Still haven't got one. Still haven't had one all these years later. And season tickets were somehow something to be much admired. Whoa, he's got a season ticket. He must be loaded. Because where we lived, you know, nobody had much around Everton Valley. They were all sons of labourers and artisans generally. Nobody had money to chuck about.
So how did you get a ticket? Did you have to buy it in advance or go on?
No such thing as tickets. You queued up and paid and went in. Unless you wanted the luxury of sitting in a seat in the stand, which was to ticket it. You don't need a ticket to get in to stand up. They just let enough in till the pip squeaked, if you like. I've been on Goodison Park when there were 74,000 spectators in. It was a match against Burnley. Might have been a boxing day. When Burnley were probably champions in about 1957-8, something like that. And I'd been on Goodison Park with 74,000 in. So they didn't bother whether you had a ticket or not. If the gates were open and they could take your money, they'd let you in.
Where did you stand for that game?
Gladys Street. Couldn't move. Absolutely rammed in. There was a gang of us who used to go from school. I suppose I was 14, 15. And we'd all sort of meet together in the middle of the standing end behind the goal of Gladys Street.
So when I've seen old footage, you can see the crowd swaying.
What was
it like in the crowd?
We didn't think too much of it in those days. Looking back on it now, it was fearsome. Absolutely fearsome. I mean, it wouldn't be tolerated now. I mean, all the post-Hillsborough, you know what I mean? And quite rightly too, it shouldn't be. But we never thought much of it. Fit young men. It was a crowd. And you were in it and tough. And I never heard of anybody suffering a personal injury. Okay, we heard of the great disasters at Ibrox Park, you know, when there was a stampede and people were killed, but that was coming out of the ground down the steps. I don't remember. It was about 1970. I think it was probably New Year's Day or New Year's Eve, because they were traditional old firm Rangers and Celtic matches, and I'm sure there were a goodly number of people who died in a crush coming out of Ibrox Park, Rangers ground, around about the very early 70s. It might have been 1970.
Right. How do you think the behaviour of the fans has changed over the years as well? So, like,
during my time, it's gone from being perfectly support the home team only, cheer for your lads in the 50s and early 60s. Then, in the late 60s and 70s, it became much more of a hate the opposition sort of approach to the players on the pitch, booing and whistling and jeering and name-calling. And, you know, it got to a horrible stage where the fans would go for a fight. The 70s were awful because the players on the pitch weren't much better. You know, there were regularly punch-ups and vicious tackling, because tackling was just tackling in those days. If it was from behind, well, it was from behind. Tough. If you happened to get the ball as part of the tackle, it was fair game, even if you'd got the man first. Used to be an old adage from some tough defenders, if you can't get the man, get the ball. How weird was that? And the likes of the skillful players like Alex Young and, you know, that genius called George Best used to get some fearful batterings from defenders who would allow to get away with it. And it relayed itself to the terraces. Everyone turned into a baying mob.
Do you think it's getting any better now?
Oh, much, 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 yeah. There's still a lot of racist chanting going on, which is a terrible thing. You do hear of it, don't you, about? And I can't abide that in any shape or form. And some hateful remarks are made to players who think they can get away with anything. You know, the John Terrys of this world, that I won't say too much about, but they do come in for some stick. Some of it deserved, I suppose, but the length to which some fans go to single out individuals is awful. I mean, David Beckham, heaven forbid, but David Beckham, when he was sent off playing for England against Argentina 8 years ago now, I suppose it was vilified, wasn't he? Effigies hung, burned, everyone calling him fearful names, chanting his wife's name.
So do you feel the fans are
much more responsible now?
The fans are entitled, though, to criticise players.
Fair game, yeah. Criticise. And their own players, too. If they feel that either not pulling their weight, or in the opposition's case, up to no good, doing something underhand. Cheating, if you like. Not playing the game properly.
Do you think Goodison has changed from when you saw the structure of it and the seating all come in? I'm sure you've seen how it's changed and developed. How would you say it's changed for better in terms of seating?
Yeah,
and
much better.
Floodlights?
The lighting bears no comparison these days. Modern lighting, you don't know. You can't even see a shadow on the pitch. The lighting from all sides is so intense. But when I went, there were four pylons. Everton were one of the first teams to put floodlighting in. Apart from, you know, these stories you hear from the Crystal Palace when there were oil lamps around the pitch so they could play at night. Apart from that, I mean, Everton were one of the earliest teams to install floodlights, certainly before Liverpool had them. I think Arsenal were one of the first teams as well. But they used to have four massive big pylons, one at each corner of the ground, with a great big bank of lights. And high up they were.
How tall were they up to the roof?
Above the roof of the stand. Oh, above the roof of the main stand, yeah. And used to shine down on the pitch. And so each player had four shadows following him around the pitch. Strange, it looked weird. And to see it on the telly, it looked like you were watching sort of game of noughts and crosses running around the pitch. Because every player was a cross, casting a distinct shadow from each of the four pylons. But nowadays, of course, the lighting is improved no end. Not only for the benefit of the players, but of course for the benefit of the TV audiences. Because they seem to play every night now, don't they? Sorry, every week there's a midweek game going on, and you can't get fabulous TV pictures like you've got these days without the places properly lit. Much, much better.
How do you think the pitch has changed as well? I mean, you're talking about the dirty players in the 70s, and the pitch for the skillful players probably wasn't, I imagine, couldn't have been as good as it is today.
I think, I don't know whether it's turf science or whatever they call it these days, but certainly sports pitches have improved no end, and certainly soccer teams' pitches have. Everybody used to remember that by now in the season the pitch would look like a great big brown diamond with grass in the corners. That's what it was like, because they got played on every week, the reserves played on them, the second team played on the pitch as well. They'd also allow other clubs to play. Local amateur teams would play on the pitch, just the same. And especially towards the end of the season when it was the local amateur cup final, you know. It was a Goodison Park or Anfield. Couldn't believe that now, could you?
Definitely not, no.
No. Just not very many weeks ago, I was at Goodison Park in a daytime with a schools thing. I work in a primary school, and we were there with some youngsters from school, and a part of it was to go in the stand and look at the pitch and go down to pitch side. And I was impressed to see at the shady end of the ground, the park end, the sun goes round that way, at the park end of the ground, even though the roof has got a sort of perspex roof on it now, so light comes through, the side at the edge, the end of the pitch that was in shadow, it was covered in great big contraptions, shining natural daylight through artificially created lights onto the pitch in the shadow part. So that was getting as much sunlight as the rest of the pitch was getting to ensure the grass was keeping going. And signs all the way around, keep off the grass, keep off the grass, keep off the grass. You know, in the 50s and 60s, It was just what they ran about on a Saturday.
Looks like a public park, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. You see them, don't you, where the goal posts are left up all the time, where that massive area in front of the goal is just worn down to nothing. Yeah, there's only Wembley that was worth oohing and aahing about right to the end of the season.
At the moment, Everton are considering moving ground or ground sharing with Liverpool. Do you feel that Everton should move away from Goodison Park with the amount of history that belongs to it at the moment?
Tough one. It's a great old ground, isn't it, Goodison? But then again, lots of teams have had great old grounds and moved and not suffered. They've suffered a bit first and then soon picked up. The best change of all, I suppose, has been Arsenal, hasn't it, to the new Emirates Stadium. Who wouldn't want to play in a stadium like that? Who wouldn't want to? What a fabulous place. The new Wembley, an amazing arena. All right, let's forget about the laying a new pitch every 2 weeks, you know, that's a bit silly. But, yeah, I think it would be a great thing for Everton to move away. But I wasn't sure about Kirby. I think staying inside the city would be good. Bear in mind, Everton were called Everton before they played at Goodison. When they moved ground, they still kept the name Everton. They didn't change it to Walton when they moved, so it's not that much of a big deal. But it would be good if they could find a ground within Liverpool, within the city boundary. I wasn't very enamoured with the idea of them moving down to a ground near King's Dock. I thought that was silly. You couldn't build a massive football stadium right next to the river, for heaven's sake.
Must have been good transport, though, for people.
It might have been, yeah. I haven't been in the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff, but I've been to it when I visited the city as a tourist, if you like, and I was amazed to walk around the corner in the town centre and there, whoa, there's the Millennium Stadium right in front of you. You go, caw, where did that come from? So it can be done, but not sure about it for Everton.
With fans, it used to be that they made the football club. Now it seems like we're talking about the new stadium. It's commercialism that makes the club live and breathe. Do you feel this is the case at the moment?
I don't know.
That the fans are losing their sort of power with the club?
Certainly losing their power, although it depends who the owner chairman is. With Bill Kenwright, I think he's listening at least. And you can be rest assured, I suppose, that whilst Bill Kenwright remains the chairman, and I know he's not a squillionaire, and I know it would be marvellous if he personally had lots more money, but whilst Bill Kenwright is there, I think we're having a bit of a say in the matter. Although I think lots of people felt as though they were being railroaded when the decision to go ahead and move to Kirby was, you know, the final one the club wanted to pursue. But they had little option, did they? It wasn't their money they were spending. It was another Evertonian, Terry Leahy, Sir Terry Leahy from Tesco, whose money they were spending. And I suppose he who pays the piper, I suppose he had a right to say, this is the development, gentlemen, take it or leave it.
Going back to, you're speaking about Kenwright, and going back to John Moore's millions, what was it like for, as an Everton fan, to have him as a chairman? And
well, at the time it was absolutely amazing. Only looking back on it now do I realise that he also was a major shareholder in Liverpool Football Club, because he was the football pool's millionaire. So what was he going to do with his money? You know, invest it in football. I suppose he could have just taken the money and run, but I suppose he wanted to invest in football. But it was a marvellous feeling, because it seemed like every couple of months, no transfer window in those days, you could sign players whenever. And there was always somebody new being brought. You know, Alex Parker from Scotland, fabulous right back. Next month, Mickey Lill from Wolves to play on the right wing. Then another fabulous player, Tommy Ring, came on the left wing. And they were popping up all over the place. It was wonderful, yeah.
What were the fees like then, the transfer fees back then?
You know, I don't know how much we paid for Alex Young, but it was 25,000 quid, £30,000. They get that up. They get much more than that a week now. Silly, but that was the scale of the money. Alan Ball came for 110,000, seems to stick in my mind. 110,000, and he was still a teenager in 1966. Big money.
Also going back to the ground, where have you sat and where's your favourite place to sit in the ground or stand back in the day?
I think to have my time all over again. No, forget the having your time. To pick a favourite spot now, I would have preferred in those days, I think, now that I'm 65 nearly, to have sat down to watch the game. Appreciate it better. Instead of being pushed and shoved. But you can't beat the thrill of being squashed in a crowd, all singing for your team. And in those days I went to a few away matches, and to be in the middle of all your own mates, if you like, in a squash, celebrating a goal or, and you know, a great moment in the game, it was unbeatable. So behind the Gladys Street is as good as it gets. However, when I was a bit older, in my later 20s, I used to go in the park end stand from time to time, because the season ticket holders were mostly in the main stand, so you couldn't get in there. And I suppose the Bullens Road might have been the same on the other side, but you could get in the park end stand if you turned up with your money and paid. And I'd go in there now and again, and it wasn't a terrifically high stand, it still isn't, but it was just high enough so you could see everything going on without being so high up that you couldn't get a feel for the play. So I suppose the park end stand would be pretty good, but high. It was a two-tier stand in those days.
It's just got redeveloped in the 90s, I think. Do you think that took away anything from being a two-tier stand to a one-tier?
It was just one great big long slope, wasn't it, right to the back.
Has that changed? Have you sat there recently and has it changed?
Oh, yeah, It doesn't feel like a football ground anymore. That park end doesn't. It's, I don't know. I don't know what it is. It just hasn't got the same feel anymore. I like the Bullens stand because the seats are a bit closer together, and you've still got that sensation of being shoulder to shoulder with fellow Blues, if you like. You don't get a fabulous view if you sit in the wrong seat. Sometimes you're stuck with a pillar in front of you. But plenty of noise and wooden floorboards, of course. You can stamp your feet and get the old boom, 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 going around the ground. You can't do that in a concrete stand.
So, do you have any match day rituals when you actually attend Goodison Park?
No, not really anymore, because I only go two or three times a season now. I suppose you might call it a ritual. It's, my son is now 32, and he's not really a Blue. To be absolutely honest, he's not really a Blue. But if he's got a spare Saturday, and I've got a spare Saturday, he lives in Manchester. His girlfriend's a Manc, supports United, shame. But if he's got a spare Saturday when she's doing something else and my missus and I are at a loose end, I occasionally will go to the match with him, and he always comes down and we have a meal together and then go to the game afterwards and have a pint on the way home. So a bit of a ritual, if you like, but nothing much more than that. Just a few weeks ago though, I went with my brother and his son. I went with my son, and we went with my daughter's girlfriend, who's another Manchester United. Where do they get them from? So five of us lads went together to the match. And I think it's more of an, you know, I'm going with family now rather than with just mates, which is what I always did as a young lad.
So do you feel going to the match itself, I mean, going there for the first time and then growing up in the stands and having the opportunity to take your own son to the match, do you feel that's a ritual that many fans take on for themselves?
Yeah, you seem to see it, don't you? You see a lot of youngsters going with their dads these days. I work in a primary school, as I said before, and Everton in the community run a scheme where they contact local schools, and for certain games during the season you can have a ticket. You have tickets for £10. Now you can pay 30 odd quid for the ticket for the game, 40 odd for the posh seats. So to get a seat for £10 is marvellous. Now our school charges 15, takes a fiver for itself, which is good business for the school.
What school is this, sorry?
It's a Broad Green Primary School in Old Swamp. So he's left us now, he left at Christmas, one of our IT technicians, well, the IT technician, Kenny, a real dyed-in-the-wool Blue. He was the one who got us involved with it, and as a result of selling tickets to parents, staff and some of the children, we'd go about 25 of us together to the game. We wouldn't go together, but we'd all sit together from the school, about 25 of us. So that was 25, £5 into the school kitty. And to do that two or three times a season was nice. Gets an extra gang of young blues going to the game who might grow up and want to go every week. And makes a bit of money for the school. So it's a nice thing for Everton and the community to be doing that, yeah.
Do you feel Everton are very strong with the community, the local community itself?
Well, I'm sure they are, because I see, they certainly come into our school and do coaching, and they come into our school and organise various other things. And just recently, I think it last year was the first time, I had a phone call from, no, I didn't get a phone call, the school had a phone call from one of the staff of an old people's residential home not far from the school. And the woman who took the message in the office said to me, there's something to do with five-a-side football. I thought, oh, folks home, five-a-side, what's she talking about? Anyway, they left the number and ring Carol on this number. So I rang, hello, yeah, Carol, yeah, oh hello, my name's Redfern, da-di-da-di-da. What's this about five-a-side? She said, oh, it's not five-a-side, she said. The organisation that runs this group of old people's homes has been approached by Everton in the community. Would you like to become involved with a tabletop football tournament? With the old people playing with kids from primary school. How about that? And it was an Everton in the community idea. So, we were invited along to take four of our little lads, two lads and two girls, along to the old folks' home. Everton in the community people brought along, you know, the full-sized tabletop table. And they had a little tournament going with the old people in the old folks' home. And there were women, old dears of 80, leaning on the Zimmers, playing tabletop football. How great is that? And then, they're all invited to send a team to play in the tournament at Goodison Park just a few weeks ago. And it's a great occasion. Now, this year, no player turned up to present the awards because David Moyes had insisted they stay behind for extra training that day for some reason or another. I forget what it was now. And so they didn't make it to the present. They were due to be there at 1 o'clock. We weren't told which player it was, but whichever player it was didn't come to present the trophy at the end. So the kids were a bit disappointed, but it was an Everton in the community effort. Very good too.
When you were a child yourself, supporting Everton, did the club have any sort of projects or anything like that that you're talking about now?
Not that I was ever aware of. The only thing I am aware of is when I was in my early 20s, I played amateur football for the school of which I used to go, you know, Allsop Old Boys, and they're still going now, they've still got teams going now, in the Zingari League and that sort of league, a good league around Liverpool in those days. And one or two of the players I played with, not Everton players, somehow got to know one of the Everton physios. And when we were injured, although I was never fortunate enough or unfortunate enough to be injured, and they could go along to Goodison or Melwood. No, Belfield. Sorry. Delete. Go along to Belfield for advice from the physiotherapist. You didn't get any direct treatment, but they'd have a look to see how their knee was getting on or their ankle or whatever it was. But that was about the only contact I think we ever had with the players.
Right.
Or the club.
So going now to the Merseyside derby, as you've mentioned, Melwood.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
What a slip, yeah.
What does it mean to you, the whole occasion and the game itself?
There are those who can't go. There are those who can't watch. I've been to a few, and you try to think it won't let it get to you. There are those who say, after all, it's only a game. But for those few hours after you've won or lost, you're a different person, aren't you? And when you go back to work on a Monday morning, you're a different person depending upon who's won. Whether you're going to get things thrown at you or whether you're going to do the throwing makes all the difference. I remember two of the best goals I ever saw scored were in derby matches. One of them was by Sharpie. I think it was at the Anfield Road end. A volley, blasted it, about 30 yards, dipped underneath the crossbar, brought the house down. Marvellous goal. We won. Don't think we've ever won since. And the other marvellous goal I saw scored was against Everton. Absolute corker. And it was by David Fairclough, super sub. Now, when I was a young man, a little lad in our street with red hair, much younger than me, 11 years younger than me. My youngest brother was 10 years younger than me. And his little pal down the street was David Fairclough. They kicked the football up and down in the street together. And occasionally, if there was a bit of a game going, the little lads were allowed to play with us. Big lads, you know. So I suppose when he was about 8 or 9, he was playing with us, who were 18 or 19. In the street still. And I remember going to work one day and saying to the lads in the office, the same ones I went to Wembley with a couple of years later, there's a little boy down our street who's a brilliant footballer, and one day he'll play for England, and it was David Fairclough. So it was a Good Friday game, or it was moved because of the Grand National, and I think it was moved to the, I think it was played on a Good Friday lunchtime at Anfield, Liverpool versus Everton. And I was listening to the commentary because I didn't go. And I don't know whether it was 0-0, 0-0, 0-0, 0-0, 0-0. And David Fairclough was brought on as substitute for Liverpool. And he got the ball on the halfway line. And he went ding, 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 ding. Passed about 4 Everton players and blasted the ball into the net, and Liverpool won 1-0. But what a goal. I saw it on the telly in a match of the day. And the only consolation I had was, well, serves me right for spotting him when he was a lad. Yeah, what a player, though. But he could only play in short bursts.
So have you been to both Goodison and Anfield?
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't. Lots of people won't set foot, will they, in the other place? Never bothered me. Because I used to go when I was a little boy, you see. I go in the boys' pen, which is something else that's changed over the years. There's no such thing anymore. They wouldn't even be allowed to call it the boys' pen anymore. Some Eurocrat would be down on them, wouldn't they, like a ton of bricks? You've got to call it the young people's enclosure or something. I suppose the nearest you've got now is the family enclosure. But I used to go in Liverpool and Everton's ground, because some of the lads I was growing up with were Liverpool fans. So we'd go in Liverpool one Saturday and Everton the following Saturday. And it was always a Saturday at 3 o'clock. And that's another thing that's changed, isn't it? You know, midday on a Sunday, what's that about? 4 o'clock. You know, what's that?
TV, isn't it?
Of course it's TV, yeah. It's the dosh, yeah. It's the dosh.
Can you just describe what the boys' pen was like when you were in there?
Right, it was at the Gladys Street end, and as you're facing the pitch, it was as far left as you could go at the back of the standing area. So it was at the corner of Gladys Street and Bullens Road, and there was probably only one entrance in the corner on Gladys Street itself, right in the corner by Bullens Road, which happened to be the furthest corner from where I lived, so we had to walk all the way around the ground to get there, and all the way around the ground through everybody who seemed to be walking the other way. And there wasn't a fabulous view, because it was a bit stuck under the roof, if you like. I mean, okay, you could see right across the pitch, but mostly for young people, that shouldn't happen, should it? If you wouldn't mind, yeah.
Yeah, back on. So you were just describing about the roof and
the boys' pen, yeah.
Yeah, the boys' pen.
But of course it was, I don't know what the age limit was either, come to think of it. Never gave it a thought at the time. I suppose it would be 15, 16, wouldn't it? Because by then people were starting to go to work, weren't they? I do remember it was sixpence to go in, which was 2.5p. 2.5p, you can't believe it, can you? Sixpence, a tanner to go in. And what do you pay now? 30-odd quid. How many times is that more? It doesn't bear thinking of that, does it? Maybe 1,000 times more.
It's inflation for you.
Pardon?
Inflation for you.
That's inflation for you. We've got to play these players fabulous wages somehow, haven't we, really?
Going back to the derby as well, what's your most memorable match in terms of Merseyside derbies? What's the one that sticks out for you?
Two, I suppose, anyway, both high scoring games. The 4-4 at Goodison.
Was that the FA Cup game?
Yeah, when Kenny Dalglish quit. Couldn't take the heat anymore. Remember? Kenny Dalglish quit. And I saw another game. And I think it was a friendly derby, but I don't know why it was being played. I think it was just a bit of a money spinning game at the beginning of the season. But it could have been a charity shield, I don't remember. But no, it couldn't have been. It may have been a charity shield, but I seem to remember Ian St John was making his debut for Liverpool against Everton. And Everton won. No, I think it was 3-3. Either Everton won 4-3 or it was 3-3. And Ian St John had scored two goals for Liverpool on his debut for Liverpool against Everton. And it was 3-2 for Everton. And the England player at the time, Roger Hunt, beat Brian Le Bon to the ball and was just about to score. He could have scored himself, but he stopped and waited for Ian St John to come up alongside him and put it in the net to give St John a hat-trick on the so that was the spirit, if you like, of the game. Whereas these days, a player would grab a goal for himself, wouldn't he?
In terms of the derby itself, and I know your family was split between Cunhead fans, how was it on derby days when you were with your family as a youngster?
It was only friendly animosity. It wasn't any of these lock yourself in the cupboard afterwards, you know, nothing like that, I don't think. My dad wasn't the sort of man to get too hung up about it. And okay, when I was with my mates, we'd all get angry and mad and hate the other lot, but I think we had more sense than to let it overcome our lives. And we certainly didn't get involved in any animosity with Liverpool and Everton fans.
How would you describe the relationship between Everton and Liverpool fans over the years?
I still like to think it's got a good basis of friendship among, you know, between the fans. I'd certainly like to think so. But, you know, going back to the very, very early days of Everton, we were the same club. And for lots of their early years, Liverpool didn't do anything without the ask what Everton were going to do. And Everton didn't do anything without the ask what Liverpool were going to do. I've read some of the very early minute books. And if they got a letter in from a charity asking what they were doing, it was the secretary to liaise with the Liverpool club, and we'll do the same. You know, it was like the same organisation, but they played in red and we played in blue. Strange. So, you know, there's still a good basis of friendship there. And I like to think that one of the best expressions of it lately has been when the little lad, Rhys Jones, was shot in the head. 11-year-old, blue. And his parents were invited to Anfield. They went to Goodison first, of course, and all the tributes were paid and all that sort of thing, and that's where the purple shirt came from. But his parents were invited to Anfield, weren't they? And stood in front of the ground and they played Everton's sick tune, Johnny Todd, the Zed Cars theme, in Anfield, to silence. How about that? And they broke out into applause. Now, you couldn't imagine City and United doing that, could you? I've been at City and United for derby games. I used to work in Manchester and there was a friend of a City season ticket holder. And I once went to Old Trafford to see United play City. What a horrible atmosphere it was. Mind you, it was in the 70s. It was 1970. And the atmosphere was horrible. Absolutely horrible. And people who come out the ground would hide the scarves underneath the coats in case one of the opposition fans picked on them. It was awful. Didn't get that at Liverpool and Everton. The Liverpool and Everton's teams always have run out beside one another onto the pitch together, a bit like they do at the cup final. Whereas other clubs, one team comes out, the other team comes out separate.
Did you feel that the incident at Hillsborough changed the relationship more positively between the fans?
Well, you know, you got the Merseyside, didn't you, famous two or three times when we met? Never won, like, but met at Wembley. Ian Rush, yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, it must have done something. But Heysel had done nothing, that was for sure. Was it because they got us kicked out of Europe because of their behaviour that day? But I think Hillsborough has gone a long way to help mend the relationship.
What was it like?
It's funny, isn't it? Tragedy is what brings out, you know, the best in the relationship. We've spoken about Hillsborough and now about poor Reece Jones, yeah.
What was it like in Liverpool at the time for Everton fans when Heysel happened? Was there any bitterness towards Liverpool fans or...
Well, funny enough, we didn't realise at the time, because it was just a horrible incident going on at a football match. It was only ages afterwards. I'm not so sure how long afterwards. I think before the start of the next season, all English teams were banned from Europe. So at the time it happened, we didn't realise the importance of it. But it was only afterwards when that lot have got us banned from Europe, it began to sink in. And even then it didn't begin to sink in that bad, but it was only when players started to leave Goodison, because they could go and play for Glasgow Rangers and play in Europe. Howard Kendall decided to go to Madrid. No, he didn't. He went to Lisbon. No,
Bilbao.
Not Lisbon. Bilbao, yeah. He went to Bilbao and started to really affect Everton. That was where the real bitterness started to come in, when we felt the full aftermath. And how long did it go on for? 5 years? When we could have been in our pomp.
Do you think the Everton itself as a club would have been in a better position now than what it is if the ban didn't occur?
I don't know. It's very, very hard to say, isn't it? Because look how teams seem to have a period when they're in the ascendancy, don't they? And without any good reason seeming to happen, suddenly they're not such a good team anymore. Dare I say, Manchester United for quite a long time were a nothing team, relegated, came back up again. Certainly in my time, relegated and came back up. So I couldn't really say. It's hard, isn't it, to say because of that Everton aren't the team they should have been. But because look where we are now. We've been in fourth position. We've mixed it with the big four, as they want to be called these days. Our time will come back, I'm sure.
Talking about away matches now, what's the furthest away match you've been to?
Oh, no question. One famous away match, Milan. San Siro Stadium, 1963. Everton were champions of England, and at the time these fellas I worked with, we all said when Everton play their first European game we're going to go. So we'd all made up our minds, and then we're all sitting around the radio waiting for the draw. Inter Milan, we'll play Everton. We thought, oh god, blimey. If they weren't champions of Europe then, they were as good as. They went on to win it that season, and we drew them in the first round. So not only were we playing the best team we could possibly have played, apart from Real Madrid, we were away, and it was a good way. It wasn't just northern France or Sweden or anywhere, it was a hike in a piston engine plane. And when we began to work out how much it was going to be, the lads who I worked with couldn't afford it. Their wives wouldn't let them go. They had families, you know. I was a young fella. So I'd said, I'm going. So I found out that the supporters club were chartering a plane, but only for members of the supporters club. Well, I'd never joined a supporters club, so I had to get down to Goodison Road, which is where the supporters club was. City Road, just a bit further up Goodison Road. Goodison Road continues and it becomes City Road on the way up to Walton Village. And the supporters club was up there in an old cinema. And my uncle Des and his wife were dyed-in-the-wool blues and supporters club members. So you had to be nominated, I think, by a fellow member in those days. So they nominated me. I went along one evening when they were there, joined a supporters club, paid me subs, whatever it was. And then we didn't know how much the charter was going to be or how much it was going to cost, but we were asked to pay a deposit. So when they had enough names, then they'd get the trip sorted. Now, I don't know how long this took place. You know, it might have been 4 weeks or 5 weeks or something to get this organised, but it all seemed to happen in no time. And they ended up committing, I seem to remember, it was something like £18 for the round trip, including a ticket for the match and a hotel stay overnight in Milan. £18, when I was on about £9 a week, £10 a week, something like that. So it was a way to go with not much money. Like half a month's pay, perhaps. So we ended up flying for 5 hours on a piston plane to Milan. I don't know how far Milan Airport is away from the city centre, but it seemed like never.
Where did you fly from?
Fly from Speak. It was a charter flight. I think it was Skyways or one of those airlines. It wasn't a British Airways or anything like that. I think it was a company called Skyways, and we were in a chartered piston-engined Douglas Dakota aircraft. Probably it had been flying in the war, I suppose, because they were built for that sort of work. And it was a long flight, and there was only me on that I knew, but you soon got talking to all the lads. And when we were about halfway there, I don't know how the news had got onto the plane, but maybe somebody who'd gone on knew. Somebody announced, you never guess who's playing right half today. Colin Harvey. Who? 18 years old, Colin Harvey, making his debut in the San Siro Stadium, Milan. Not many of us saw Colin Harvey make his debut for Everton, but I did. And we played the first leg at Goodison, 0-0. Typical defensive man-to-man marking.
Did
Italian.
You go to that game, did you?
I was there, yeah. Catenaccio, they used to call it, didn't they? Everyone in chains, following your man round the pitch. If the ball was nowhere near, kick him anyway. That sort of Italian defending. And it was new to us, we couldn't break through. Roy Vernon hit the post from about 6 yards when it was easy to score. Should have seen his face. I was right behind the goal, and it was, oh no.
Was that the Gladys Street end, was it?
Behind the Gladys Street, hit the post and it came out again. Funny story about that game, when I was going to pay for my ticket, the tickets were on sale, they put the prices up, and it was 5 shillings to get in, 5 bob. 25 pence in today's money. 5 shillings though to get in, when it would normally have been about 2 shillings, 3 shillings maybe. But they put the prices up because we were playing Milan. And I went along to buy 4 tickets. And I don't know how come, but I think somebody had given me, and I went along and I had a £5 note. How come I had a £5 note? I have no idea. But I pushed my £5 note under the turnstile. 4 tickets, please. And he gave me 1, 2, 3, 4 tickets. Then he counted out 1, 2, 3, 4 pound notes change. And one of them was a fiver. 1, 2, 3, 4. I picked them up. 4 tickets. Walked through the turnstile. Didn't dare look over my shoulder. Kept going. And I prized my fingers apart when I got outside the ground and looked. Yes! I got £8 change for a fiver. A fiver and 3 ones for £4. So I made a bit of a profit. So that went towards my trip.
Brilliant.
To the away game. Yeah. Forgotten to mention that before. Yeah. And in those days, San Siro Stadium, it was a shared ground in those days. AC Milan and Inter both played at the same ground. 80,000 seats. 80,000 seats, yeah.
Still shared, isn't it?
They're still shared, yeah. So, and they seem to manage all right.
Yeah.
Don't they?
Exactly.
Yeah, they seem to manage all right. And it was just a football ground. But I think that ground was built by Milan municipality, if you like, the city council built the ground after the war. I think Milan got knocked about a bit because it was an industrial city, and I think the city council built the ground for both teams to play it, and they work fine. I don't know whether it works fine, whether the fans think so, but I'm sure they're well used to it by now, 50 years later, aren't they?
Sorry, you were talking about the stadium itself. What was it, seaters or was it standing?
It was all seats, but there were no... Well, in the part where we were, they weren't actual seats. They were just deep concrete steps to sit on with numbers painted on them. So we had a ticket for the ground, and you knew what row you were in and what seat you were sitting by, but you were only sitting on a number painted on the front of the concrete. There was no formal seat to sit on. And I don't think there was a roof over any part of the stand that I was in, certainly. We were quite near the front, so most of the noise was coming down from behind us.
How was the atmosphere different to English crowds?
Couldn't believe it. I'd never heard whistling, you know, constant, like you're used to it now, constant catcalling and whistling whenever Everton had the ball. You can imagine, 80,000 Italians, it seemed to us, all whistle, 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 non-stop the whole game, whenever Everton had the ball.
And
on the pitch, fierce competition. They were not much better than us.
What's the score in the game?
1-0 to them. And they were happy with 1-0. Horrible game. They scored, I think it was their right winger, a Brazilian, even in 1963, they had a flipping Brazilian playing on the right wing for Jair, his name was. Jair da Costa. I remember him. And he belted one from the edge of the area, just underneath the crossbar. Gordon West sniffed it, but didn't get anywhere near.
Any famous names in that Inter team that you saw?
Inter
Milan
team. Inter team. I think their left back was Facchetti, who played left back against... Sorry, no, I'm getting them mixed up. Left back was Facchetti. Their captain, I think, was called Guarneri. Big, long-legged centre-half who used to come up with the ball, and two other players would drop in behind him and play defensive. Centre-half never went in the other half of the field in those days, but he did. Guarneri, his name was. But their famous number 10, Luis Suarez, a Spaniard, but played for Inter. What a player. Brilliant player. In fact, his reputation at the time as a Spanish player was so great, he wore the number 10. The Spaniards used to call a 10% coin Luisito, a little Luis Suarez, the Luisito. That was the name for the coin, like we call sixpence a tanner on a shilling. It was a bob. Well, in Spain, it was a Luisito, Luis Suarez. They were the three. I can't remember their goalie's name, but he was Italy's goalie at the time.
Looking back at that game itself and being in the stadium, do you feel that was the future of football?
Yeah. The outside of the ground was phenomenal. It was a massive, big, open space. We were only used to streets and going around the corner and there's the ground, you know, built in a street sort of thing. This was a big, open space. Loads of room, car parks, coach parks. And it was... I'm not too sure whereabouts it was in relation to the city centre, but we seemed to be driving for quite a way on the coach from where our hotel was, which was quite near the city centre, in masses of traffic, solid traffic, beep, beep, beep. You can imagine what Italian traffic is like now. Well, it was just as bad then, it seemed to us. But the experience, we were practically able to drive right up to the ground. And the coach driver was giving us instructions, you know, I'll be exactly on this spot. And he was only speaking French, because we couldn't speak Italian. A few of us could speak a bit of French. And he was talking French to us, telling us where he was going to meet us and what time and everything after the game. And I remember one fella, we'd stayed at the hotel, and the idea was that all the supporters club fans were meeting in the hotel lobby, then we were going over the road for something to eat before the match. Because it was kicking off about 8 o'clock, it did in those days in Italy, when it was cooler. Kick off about 8 o'clock, so we went for something to eat about 6 o'clock in the hotel, and then when we remembered we had something to eat, we were all getting on the bus to go. And we haven't been driving very far, and suddenly we heard a rumbling noise. And the bottles of wine. Bottles of wine were going under the seats. People had smuggled bottles of wine on board the coach. The driver was not very pleased at all. I don't know whether they were stolen from the hotel, but they were. They certainly made their way off the tables into the bus. Just a little story. So even in those days, you see, booze on the coaches.
Did you bring back a souvenir from Italy?
Yeah, I brought back some pennants. We went in just a local shop, I suppose, but it seemed to have club pennants. You know, in those days when the captain shook hands at the end of the match, when they tossed up, there was always a photograph. And they'd exchange, when you were playing somebody from another country, they'd exchange a club pennant, like on a bit of wood with ribbon hanging down the sides, or a bit of tassel with the proper club colours and everything. Now, Everton didn't have one, so I don't know. Oh, I think they gave a little flag, but they definitely changed something. So I went and bought a blue and black striped one, which was Inter, with the club crest in the middle, and a red and black one for AC Milan. Oh, and I bought a black and white one as well for Juventus. Bought all three of those back, although, you know, we were only playing one of those teams. You had to go back with something. And I can't... I do know they did produce a programme, and I do know I had one, because Everton's one of the other midfield players that was playing that day, Dennis Stevens, his name was spelt wrong in the programme. It said Dennis Stovens with an O. Silly, but that's something silly that stuck in my mind. But I don't remember for the life of me having the programme years later. I had the pennants, and I probably still have them somewhere up in a trunk in the loft, but they were hanging up in my bedroom, you know, for a good long time as a bit of a souvenir from a foreign trip, you know.
So what's your favourite away ground and why?
Well, as impressive stadiums, I've not seen Everton play at these two places, but I've been to them, but sadly not for a game. I've been as a tourist and done the tour. One of them is the Bernabeu in Madrid. Not Bernabeu, it's Bernabeu, if you say it properly. And what a fabulous place. Go in their trophy room.
When was that you went to?
Within the last 10 years, when I was on a trip to Madrid with my wife for a holiday. And I said to her, I'm not leaving Madrid until I've been to the Bernabeu Stadium. She said, okay. And we went. And a funny little story. They do a stadium tour, you know. And I was in a very short queue. There were only a few people wanting to go. By the time we found it and then got the metro out to the stadium. Across the road, and there was the ground. Whoa, what a marvellous looking thing. But you don't get the right impression from outside of how big it is when you get in. So we paid to go in the turnstile. And, oh no, you didn't pay. You paid at a little ticket window. And there was an old fella there. Huh, listen to me, an old fella. Anyhow, I said, two please. And he said how much it was, €3, €4, something like that. And I just scooped the tickets up, took my change, and I was walking away. I looked at the two tickets, and he'd given me one full price ticket and a half price ticket. But charged me for two full price tickets. And I thought, you're robbing so and so. He's on the make. You'd think you go to a place like Real Madrid, wouldn't you? And you could trust somebody not to try and rob you. So I spoke a bit of Spanish and I went back. Hey, señor, usted es un robo. And the look on his face, I called him a robber. And he went, huh? So when I showed him the two tickets, I thought he was going to give me €2 back, but he didn't. He kept the money and swapped it for two full price tickets. But at least I'd paid the proper price, and he hadn't put the €2 in his pocket. I presume he'd try it on the next person, or the next person, because I could understand what it said in Spanish. You know, I knew it was a pensioner's ticket he'd given me, but charged me full price. Anyway, to go in the Bernabeu Stadium, their trophy room was unbelievable. You know, I think they'd won 6, 7 European trophies, European Cups, five on the trot. Bear in mind, the first five, they won them all. That's pretty good, isn't it? One way and another. And some of the great players, you know, to see their pictures up there, Puskás and Di Stefano and Gento, who, you know, were the fabulous, the start of the Galacticos in those days. But, and even the missus was impressed, you know. And then you got to go down through the players' changing rooms. Beckham was playing. No, Beckham was playing for them. That's right. We saw Beckham's shirt hanging up, you know, the usual. And then onto the pitch. And you should see the way that ground goes. Whoa, up like that. Beautiful. But the grass isn't all grass. It's mixed with artificial turf.
I didn't know that.
Because it's so steep. You know, lots of it is in shade, lots of the time. So it's not all grass. And the tour guide told us that, because he was talking in Spanish, then back to English, Spanish, English, because there were mostly Spanish and English people there. And I happened to go in the ground, stood up on the top balcony looking at the ground with a Spanish man and his grandson it was. And when I told him I was from Liverpool, he was most impressed. Then I told him I supported Everton and he looked at me as if to say, who are they? Sad, very sad. But yes, a marvellous ground. But I also went to Barcelona and went in the Nou Camp, and that's another fabulous stadium. It was pouring with rain the day we went, absolutely lashing down, so it didn't have the walk on the pitch feel about it with the sun overhead and everything. But an equally impressive ground, the Nou Camp, and I would have loved to have gone and seen a game there, because that looked even steeper still when you're right at the top. Two fabulous grounds. I only wish I'd been to see a game there.
Never know.
You never know. Next season? Oh no. Well, certainly not, I would think.
So have you been to any of the international games?
I saw all the World Cup matches in 1966 played at Goodison Park.
What games were on at Goodison Park?
Bulgaria, Portugal, Hungary and Brazil were in the same group, I think. Yeah, they were. And so I saw Pelé play for Brazil. I saw Eusebio play for Portugal. The star man for Bulgaria was somebody called Georgi Asparuhov, a tall, elegant footballer. Hungary had their star player at the time was called Varga, I think his name was, and there was two inside players, Varga and Farkas, and fabulous players they were. Everything happened on the ground, and they had a tall centre forward as well. Oh, some, forgotten his name, and another little striker. They used to play two strikers. One was called Benet. Scored a lot of goals. Great players. Then in the later rounds, Portugal, I think, won the group, therefore played again at Goodison, and the team that won the Manchester group came across and played at Goodison, and one of the other groups anyway, and they played South Korea. Portugal played South Korea. Now Portugal were going to go on to get to the semi-final. They were a really good team, but blow me, Korea were three up in the first half. Before the half an hour was up, Korea had gone three up, because they were all little fellas running around like bees in bottles, tearing around the pitch. Their star player was somebody called Pak Doo-ik, sticks in my mind, and he was smaller than me. They all looked like clockwork mice, never stopped running, and they put three past Portugal, and place was rocking, because we were all cheering for the underdogs. And it happened to be my best mate in the street at the time, Don Wells. His brother had arranged to get married on that day, because we didn't know, of course, that was going to happen. You know, he just fixed his wedding up a year before, and it was that day, so he couldn't come. So I saw this game. South Korea 3, Portugal 4. And I think Eusebio scored all the goals. I might be embroidering that a bit. He certainly got a hat trick. What a game.
Did you feel like when you were seeing players like this, it was like
once in a lifetime, that's for sure. And these were the best of the best. Yeah, Eusebio, fabulous player. And a real gentleman. Everyone playing at the time and since said, what a fabulous man to play alongside or against. Very, very fair, always with a smile on his face. If he fouled you, he'd apologise, you know. If he knocked you over, he'd pick you up. That sort of thing. But Pelé, world beater at the time. The best player on the planet, no doubt about it at all. In the first match, Brazil played Bulgaria at Goodison Park, and the Bulgarians kicked him merciless. Battered him. And he didn't play for the second match. I don't think he played for the second game. And I think that might have been against Portugal, but he came in for the next match. I've forgotten who that was against now. No idea, can't remember. Hungary it was. It was Hungary, played against Hungary. And Hungary scored first, and we all thought, hey, up, there's a game on here. Now, I forget who won that game, but Pelé came on the pitch, could hardly play at all, but they wanted him on for his little bit of extra magic, and Brazil were knocked out. I don't think they made it out of the group, which is unheard of, because their star man, well, one of their star men, the other one was on the right wing called Garrincha, a little, very, very fast winger. They used to say he played with his boots on the wrong feet, because he could hit the ball with more of a swerve that way, but an apocryphal story maybe.
How old were you when you went to this?
Well, I was 21 that year. I'd been 21 between Everton winning the cup in May that year and the World Cup being played in the July. I'd been 21 on July the 3rd, and so I could do no wrong that summer, could I really?
Yeah, it was a great summer.
Yeah, and then in the later rounds, in the semi-final, the organisers, the FA, had always said that if England get to the semi-final, they'd play at Goodison Park. That was what was due to happen. The winner of that group would play, you know, and it was going to be England. But at the last minute, they changed it, so England played again at Wembley. So England played all their group games at Wembley. They played the quarter-final at Wembley. Suddenly it was switched, so they played the semi-final at Wembley as well. It was originally intended so that, to be fair to the teams who hadn't played at Wembley before, they could have a turn of playing at Wembley in their semi-final before hopefully England came back to play against them at Wembley in the final. But the FA changed it, so England played another game at Wembley. So we were denied seeing England play against Portugal in that semi-final at Goodison Park. And there were some banners at the ground, I think, protesting about it. However, we saw West Germany play Russia, and I think the Germans won 2-0. I think it was 2-0. But Lev Yashin was the goalie for Russia. Legend of a goalie, you know, the best in the world. There he was, standing in front of me, just, you know, no distance away at all.
Was this in the Gladys
making
again?
Saves? No. Funny enough, I don't know why, but I was at the Park End that week, that match. No idea. I think because you had to get tickets in advance, you just had to get what you could. And I was at the Park End for that game. Although I do remember being at the Gladys Street End for the Portugal game against Korea. Lev Yashin played. And of course for Germany, they went on to play the final. Uwe Seeler, Franz Beckenbauer, all those great players they had that made it to the final, but mercifully lost to England.
What were the fans like in the ground at the time? Were they from the other countries?
Oh yeah, there were lots. Oh, we'd never